This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, Jenny Murray welcoming you to the Woman's Hour podcast. Now, my first encounter with Phoebe Waller-Bridge was sitting in front of her in a little theatre in Soho at the opening night of the play Touch, written by her best friend Vicky Jones. It was soon after the first series of Fleabag began. We said a polite hello to each other, and it all came back to me when we met again late last week. So, you've come on a bit since I saw you.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Amazing.
Absolutely mad, yeah.
It has been amazing.
Yeah. It has. I can't really. Yeah.
Amazing being the operative word. Has there ever been such a speedy rise to international fame and fortune for bringing extraordinary and unusual female characters to the screen? Fleabag began in 2016. The second series was last year. Killing Eve, with Villanelle, the well-dressed contract killer, started in 2018. Series 2 was last year. And there's another on the way. Then she was co-opted into the writing team of the new James Bond film. In the last 12 months, she's won 3 Emmys for acting and writing, 2 Golden Globes, a Critics' Choice Award, and a Screen Actors Guild Award. And they were all collected wearing fabulous frocks. And now there's a book of all the Fleabag scripts and her reflections on colleagues, friends and family. Why has she called it The Scriptures, with a big banner declaring it's a love story?
Well, we thought The Scriptures was just a nice little riff on the theme of the second series. And I feel like the combination of the two series is a love story, and I think it was one of my favourite lines from the second series, this is a love story. And it was possibly because once I'd written that first scene of her in the bathroom, I wrote that before I knew anything else about the series. I sort of wrote that and went, oh, it's going to be a love story. Let's see how this pans out. That's the sort of aesthetic of it. But it was such a special thing putting the book together, because I got to revisit the writing process as well, really, and go back into the... You see my stomach rumble then? I'm going to take a nibble out of this microphone if I'm not careful. Yeah, just to go back and remember writing it and all the stage directions and what was going through my mind at the time.
So who is Fleabag? I mean, where did she come from?
When I was in my 20s and I was feeling quite cynical, when I was standing on the precipice, and I say this in a bit, but I was standing on the precipice of being sort of too cynical, or becoming a little bit depressed about the pressures of society, and starting to wake up to the reality of, you know, the pressures that women are under, and men as well, but particularly women. And I felt that if I looked down over the precipice into the chasm below, at the bottom was Fleabag, you know, wearing lipstick and looking up at me. It was the worst case scenario of a kind of spiral of self loathing and judgment. The play is darker, I think, than the TV show, and that's where it all started as a play. But it was really about a woman who felt that she was really valued primarily by her sort of sexual desirability. And I just really wanted to write about that, but in a way that was accessible and funny, so people didn't realise that's what it was about until it sneaks up on you.
But what's with her seeing sex in everything? I mean, that moment when she's in bed and there's Obama on the television news. I thought, oh, come on,
surprised. You sound surprised. I believe that's quite a relatable moment in the TV show. Yeah, well, actually, in the play, I wanted her to sexualise absolutely everything. So in the first couple of paragraphs, she sexualises her pizza. She calls her pizza a slutty pizza, and she sexualises... I mean, at one point, she even kind of sexualises her dad, you know, but it's in this kind of... It's this sort of offhand, witty way, so you think that she's just doing it for effect. But actually, ideally, when you realise that it's so relentless, you realise that there's actually something else going on underneath, that she is actually... preoccupied by it. But yeah, so we stripped some of that out for the TV show, but Obama, that was never going to go anywhere. That is a truism. Well, he represents hope, and hope is sexy.
But that, how difficult was it for you personally, Phoebe, not Fleabag, to deal with the way women's sexuality was everywhere? I mean, we even see a naked woman advertising a mortgage.
Yeah, that was important to me, because I'd felt, again, in my early 20s, and it was only really dawning on me, because you get these messages fed your whole, you know, our whole lives. And but I only started really zoning in on them in my early 20s when I'd be on the tube and I'd see a woman in her bra looking sort of delighted at a pencil case she just got or something. And I was like, that seems... something's not quite right about that. And then I just felt that sort of that we always had to be perfect and pert and looking gorgeous before anything else. Like, if you're in that position when you are looking good, you can then start your day. And I really started feeling that. And so the advert, it was so funny coming up with that, though, with the art department. Cause we were sort of like, I mean, the woman is masturbating naked on a bed about getting a mortgage. I mean, it's very subtle, but it made the point for me anyway.
Now, we spoke to Vicky Jones some time ago, who I know wrote Fleabag with you about her play Touch. She mentioned in that interview a most wonderful best friend. Now, I assume she meant you.
I hope so. She didn't actually write it with me. She directed the stage play and she developed the stage play with me. And it wouldn't exist without her. I don't know if I'd have a career without her. We met when we were both out on the hustle, she was trying to be a director and I was trying to be an actor. And she just had so much faith from the off. And I think that's such a unusual thing when you're an actor as well, because everybody, you know, when actors coming out of drama school to directors who are already in the industry are basically just like swarms of rats coming out every year, being like just trying to nibble on them. And I remember telling, like, approaching her and saying, if you ever have anything that you need a kind of, you know, 23-year-old girl for, I mean, my bracket was basically, I was like, I'll do anything. And she was so enthusiastic and she was like, oh my God, it's so exciting that you want to be an actress, and of course we'll work together. And then we did. And then we started our theatre company. And it just became about making stuff that was exciting to us and that cracked us up or made us feel like excited. And that was when it all really changed. And then she really, really pushed me to write and then directed all of my stuff. And then a few years into that, when that sort of started going well, I suddenly was like, now, hold on a second. Now you write something. And then she did. She wrote The One and Touch, which were both smash hit plays. And now she's just written her first show, which she created, which is going to be on HBO anytime now.
So how much did that incredibly close and important friendship influence you embarking on a story about a woman dealing with the loss of such a friendship?
Well, it was hugely influential, because I wrote a lot of Fleabag from the point of view of worst case scenarios. And I looked at everything that was precious to me in my life and I imagined having them all taken away. as a good starting place for a dramatic character. And then the revelation that the reason Boo had died was because of something that Fleabag did. So the fact that she'd be blaming herself for losing her own friend. That was a gutting day, but exciting one. And I was developing it with Vicky, and I was like, where's the twist? Where's the twist? There's a twist in this, because I was just writing it as it was coming out. And I just couldn't find, and all the things were in place. You know, there was a woman who was obsessed with sex, who felt like that was the only validation she needed and could get from the world. And she also had her best friend who, and I'd written that her best friend had died trying to punish her boyfriend for cheating on her. And I had just, the missing link was that it was Fleabag. And it took me sort of 3 weeks to have those things floating in front of me. And I was with Vicky. And then I suddenly had the revelation. And I went, it was Fleabag who slept with her boyfriend. And then Vicky looked at me and just went, no, sorry, no, that can't be the case. No, I'm sorry, that's too upsetting. And I was like, the reason you're saying that, she got so upset. And she was like, okay, that has to be it, because it was too upsetting. But the idea of like being disconnected from my family so much, or losing my mum, or having been the cause of my friend's death, you know, all of those things fed into it.
And you wouldn't sleep with her boyfriend,
no,
would you? Under no circumstances whatsoever.
Circumstances, absolutely not. And that's the thing, it's scary when you're writing things, because sometimes things feel so uncomfortable writing them. And I think that's when you feel like you're getting to an interesting place with writing. Because when I did say that to Jones, the instant I said it, we both imagined going through, like, if that had happened between the two of us, and actually how you would survive it. And to be honest, we were sort of like, we probably would survive something like that, because we are the greatest love story in each other's life, and we obviously trust each other not to do that sort of thing. But yeah, that kind of heartbreak, that kind of betrayal from a friend is, It can feel Shakespearean in its pain and its drama.
Is it slightly scary that a lot of people watching it might assume it's all autobiographical?
Yeah, I mean, I had let that go quite early on, because I assumed people would. And I called it Fleabag, which is my family nickname, so I was asking for trouble.
Yes, you thank your family at the end of the book for calling you Flea.
Yes, yeah. And I assumed that there will be people that would think it's autobiographical, but I hope that that people don't think that I did that, because I didn't. I wouldn't.
It's interesting that the term bromance has been around for a long time. The assumption that there might be a romantic element even to a straight relationship, a friendship between two men. Why do you suppose there isn't more written about that element of romance in a female friendship?
I think probably because stories of, you know, there are more male writers published in the world, and there are more like male driven stories in the world, and they, you know, they've dominated the industry for, well, I mean, forever. Because I think friendships are the greatest romances of our lives. I think, and Vicky and I always would joke that our boyfriends were our mistresses to our marriage and our love story, which doesn't go down so well with the boyfriends, I've got to say. But they are, I think they're so profound and complex that actually just seeing kind of like giggly girl gang kind of portrayals is something we've become used to, that girls are sort of cliquey, or they're just sort of like that gossipy thing. But what runs deeper, I think female relationships have such depth, because they begin from a place, I think women, I don't want to generalize, but we learn to talk to each other from such an early time in our lives, and we can skip the bullshit. I don't know if I could say bullshit.
You just did.
Yeah, just did. But I find there's a quick way to sort of skip it. And that was the thing when I met Vicky, and we can say that we love each other, and it's an easier thing for us to say. And I mean, within a week, I was like, I think I love you. And then Jenny, who is working with me now and has been developing the second series of Fleabag, and then she, and then with Killing Eve as well, it's the same thing. I picked up the phone to her to start working together, and I heard her voice, and it was love at first voice again. I fell in love again.
There is an encounter in series two with Kristin Scott Thomas' character where Fleabag says, well, she's not strictly a lesbian, and then she moves to kiss her. Mm. Villanelle in Killing Eve pursues sexual relationships equally, it seems to me, with men and women. why are you never keen to really define a character's sexuality?
Because I think people, I think the most interesting characters have an element of surprise about them. And whether that's that they're surprising themselves or they're surprising the audience or they're surprising somebody else in the room. And I think that's really how I like to approach my life. And I think the moment you define yourself or define somebody else, you're limiting yourself.
People are all we've got. So grab the knight by its nipples and go and flirt with someone. No, that's not what I meant. Oh, I wish you were my type. You know, take this top back to my party and go and find someone to actually do that with.
I'll do it with you.
No.
Why not?
Honestly?
Yeah.
Can't be arsed, darling.
And I think the characters that I've been writing that have that, they are open to, they're actually desperate to be surprised by themselves and by the world and by other things. And they are open. And also I just think now we're living in a time where, you know, it's starting to be part of the conversation where people saying that, you know, you can be fluid and I don't want to define myself. And I just think that's a really wonderful thing that's starting to happen. And my characters are basking in it.
How comfortable are you with writing about women who are full of rage or extremely violent, which, of course, Finn and Elliot?
Mm. Very comfortable. extremely
You've done
comfortable.
You've quite well out of them, haven't you?
Yeah. I think, for me, as long as it's not without the other side of the story. So for me, Villanelle is interesting because she's so incredibly vulnerable and childlike moments before or after she commits this heinous act of violence. For me, that's what makes it interesting. I'm not interested in a character who's just going to go and murder lots of people or shoot lots of people, or if she's just brutal. I want to see the whole picture. And I also am excited by extremes as much as the detail. The fact that she can be so gentle with a piece of clothing that she adores and then just like smash somebody's eyeball with a pin. And she sort of has the same amount of excitement and thrill from both was exciting to me because you don't really see people's extremes in real life. I mean, ideally, you'll never see that extreme version of anybody. And it's just rare to see that in women, I think, in female characters. Because I think the pressure with female action heroes or ones who are violent, they normally have to be sort of badass and not necessarily be connected emotionally to it. And I think I knew that like what I was saying earlier about the opening of Fleabag 2, when Fleabag had a bloody nose, I'd written that before I knew what the series was going to be about. That just, I sat down to write, and that was the first scene that came out, and it told me so much about where we were going to go. But I was as surprised by that first scene than anybody. And I was like, gosh, who hit her? And why is there violence? And I think I'd been really influenced by the writing Villanelle, that there is something electric about writing about women in violence, because it's rarely portrayed, I think, with that extra emotional element to it.
There seems to me to be a degree of shame about feminism in the Fleabag stories. Why the worry that she wouldn't be such a feminist if she had bigger tits?
I mean, I don't know how to describe that. That to me was just, it was a joke that has been around on my post-it wall for a really long time that just felt truthful. And without sort of unpacking it, I guess there was just a little bit of magic in that joke for me that just felt like, oh, there was just something honest in it and something funny and wry. And then just put that on the wall and put it away. I actually wrote that so long ago. I think it was even Crashing, my first series. Tried to get it into the first series of Fleabag. Sometimes it was in a man's mouth, sometimes it was in a woman's mouth. But it never really fit, which made me think maybe it just doesn't quite fit anywhere. But with Fleabag, her relationship with feminism is so complex because she's vulnerable with it. She doesn't understand the rules of it. She knows in her bones that it's the thing that she wants to be and she wants to identify as a feminist, but she feels like she's letting feminism down all the time. And in that scene, she's embarrassed by it because It's a secret even she didn't know about herself.
Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, what am I going to say? What am I going to say? I sometimes worry that I wouldn't be such a feminist if I had bigger tits.
Most of the turns to the camera is when she tells us what she really thinks. And that one, she surprised herself, and it's a dirty secret that actually she wishes she was more perfect, and that feels like it was an attack on feminism itself.
And what's Phoebe's relationship with feminism as opposed to Fleabag's?
Well, very similar. And particularly when I wrote the play, I felt the same thing, which is that scene in the first series when somebody asked them if they would trade 5 years of their life for the perfect body. I would have been the girl with the hand up. I'd have been like, hell yes. And then thinking that was honest and thinking that's empowering because it's honest and yet feeling at the same time that it's letting the side down and not really knowing what the rules were. But then caring so deeply about women and equality and the basic principles of feminism and then being slightly frightened by the nuances and that there are traps out there. And I still feel like that. I still get, even when I start being asked by it, I still a little bit, my heart starts beating a little bit faster because I know that there are mines that you can step on. And I think I'll probably always have that.
You often seem to be inviting the audience to cheer on occasions like there's that thing about women's hair. And I wonder what confidence you gained from realising that the audience on the whole was coming with you.
But when I realise people are responding to particular bits, like the hair speech, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, it's the best feeling in the world. I think because it's such a small... When things start like a small idea, like the fact that the hair speech got picked up and that people were relating to it. You know, I sometimes have these ideas and you think, like, I'll have a conversation with my sister and I'll just say, why is hair so stressful? Why is hair... Why is it so stressful? And why does it feel like it's everything? And then we have such a relief talking to each other about it, a sense of relief. And then that sort of goes away. But then a kernel of it stays in the back of my mind. And then I think, oh, I'll just write a little bit about that just as a nod to that conversation I had with her or just because it feels a little bit true. And those are always the ones that surprise you and blow up because they're these little truisms. And I think when that happens, that's when I just feel a little bit less alone in the world because I'm like, you too? Oh, thank God.
That is exactly what she asked for.
No, it's not. We want compensation.
Claire?
I've got two important meetings and I look like a pencil.
No, don't blame me for your bad choices. Hair isn't everything.
Wow.
What?
Hair is everything. We wish it wasn't, so we could actually think about something else occasionally, but it is. It's the difference between a good day and a bad day. We're meant to think that it's a symbol of power, that it's a symbol of fertility. Some people are exploited for it and it pays your fucking bills. Hair is everything, Anthony.
People have often said you have written every woman in Fleabag. She, like you, comes from a rather privileged background. And I wondered how concerned you were that audiences might look at her and think, what's she got to worry about with a millionaire sister?
Yeah, I mean, it was a concern and wasn't a concern because that was her circumstances. Her circumstances, I had decided that was going to be her life. And there are moments where she feels apologetic about it. And there are moments in my life when I feel apologetic about it. And I think part of her whole character is that she knows. There's a moment when she says to the therapist in the second season, she goes, I don't need help. I have a nice life. Just tell me how not to do this one bad thing. And I think that's part of her anxiety is, I can't complain. I'm not complaining. I'm fighting. I'm telling you I'm fine all the time. And then you slowly see that inside she's crumbling with her own, you know, with her own issues and her own self-loathing. It was really important to me that she didn't complain about her lifestyle and that she wasn't complaining about not having money. I think it's really important when you just see a character fight for something or fight against something. And she was fighting to make the audience believe that she was fine rather than trying to elicit sympathy from them. I think if she'd been doing that, then I think it would have pissed people off.
Now, we mentioned your sister recently on the programme because we did a piece about the new Emma and the beautiful score that she has written for it. But I wondered, how much do you draw on your relationship with her to create your relationship with Claire in the series?
Well, Claire's not anything like my sister. So the character herself was built completely from a completely isolated point of view. And it was actually very inspired by Sian Clifford, who plays Claire, and knowing that I wanted to write something for her and everything she brought to that character, and then I would build it. You know, she's very sort of uptight and corporate and is nothing like that at all. But there are elements of the dynamic which are so accurate to us. Like when they sort of, you feel like they're completely different people and yet they have exactly the same sense of humour, or they connect on something in a way that seems really private just to them, and that there is a sense of undying, eternal love. And I have that with both my siblings, that, you know, it's the depth of it. But there are a couple of little moments in there which are just little things, almost like for Izzo. And I'm just like
what?
Well, they're for Izzo. They're just for her.
At the end of the book, you thank all your collaborators, including your family. As we said, they had called you Flea. But you say you wish you'd protected them better from the impact of Fleabag. What do you mean by that?
That was from a podcast, wasn't it? That's not in the book. That'd be quite intense if I put that in the book. Like, it's a happy book. I just think you just don't know what's going to happen when you write something and you put it out in the world, and your dream is that it hits and people love it and people care about it. And I had sort of fortified myself to that a little bit because that's sort of what you're building towards the whole time. But, you know, my family's not in the edit every day. They're not in the writer's room. They're not building up. They're not doing the press. They're not feeling this machine start to work. Suddenly, you know, they're going about their own lives, and then suddenly the show comes out and boom, people are talking about the show. They have they want to connect with my family or want to talk about it. And it's just a bit of a shock, I think, when you become quite visible suddenly. And we've got quite a unusual surname, so I think people know that. It's like my mum, it's Mrs. Waller-Bridge. So I think it's just like a wave hitting you, and that they just weren't prepared for. But I mean, it was lovely. I suppose it was just having some foresight and saying, but then you never want to be the person who goes, guys, this is going to be huge. Put your armbands on. So, yeah, I just think in hindsight, just to say, this show is emotional and about family and about friendships.
And a little bit rude from time to time.
And a little bit rude.
How did the parents go down with that?
Oh, well, I am my mother's daughter, so... And my dad loves the show. You know, I can't, you know, they brought me up, so it's on them, really.
We've got this far without much discussion of the hot priest. How did that...
Both of us have been thinking about him the entire time, though, right?
I know. I mean, how did that character come about, and how did you persuade Andrew to do it?
Andrew. Andrew was a huge, huge part of this whole process. I knew that I wanted the show to have something to do with religion, because when I look back over my notebook that I'd been keeping while I was writing Killing Eve, whenever I'd have an idea for Fleabag, I'd put it in a notebook. And I read through all of them, and there were so many religious jokes, religious ideas, things about faith. And I was sort of like, whoa, sort of wasn't expecting that. So I knew there'd be a religious element to it. And I knew that Fleabag was going to meet somebody. And so the perfect meeting of those two ideas was Fleabag meets a priest. But it seemed almost too on the nose. And I sort of resisted the idea for a while, especially because there've been so many priests in comedy that it's almost sort of a crowded market of like iconic priests, and I was like, I don't want to take that on, and I don't want to fall into the traps myself of trying to make him a kind of comedy priest. And then I thought, but what if Andrew Scott played him? And suddenly he just crystallised in my mind as a very real person.
So you're a cool priest, are you?
A cool priest?
Yeah.
No, I'm a big reader with no friends. Are you a cool person?
Oh, I'm a pretty normal person.
A normal person?
Yeah, a normal person.
What makes you a normal person?
Well, I don't believe in God.
I love it when he does that.
Because Andrew is very grounded and has such a huge heart and is unafraid of the complexity of emotions when he's performing. And so I met him at the Soho Theatre where we first met to do a play 10 years ago. And we had a coffee and he was like, what's going on? And I just said, I need you to be in the show because it needs to be built around you. And then I told him about how I wanted the character to be a man first and then a priest, if that makes sense, that we meet him and he's complex and kind and funny, but with his own damage. And he's somebody who is a match for Fleabag because the men that she met in the first season, she can reduce to tube rodent or bus rodent, as he's called in the TV show, or arsehole guy. She finds it, she just wants to be able to reduce somebody. And he's the one person that she can't do that to. And so Andrew, I was talking to Andrew about love and we're talking about it being a love story. And he said that he'd wanted to play love for a really long time. And then he said, I want you to come. He was like, let me show you something. And we walked around Soho and he took me to the Quaker Hall that is actually featuring in the show. And as we were talking about faith and love and sex and relationships, and we walked into the Quaker Hall and he said, this is a beautiful little haven in the middle of the kind of chaos of the city. And we sat there and talked for another hour or 2 hours or something, the two of us, breaking all the rules of silence
in the Quaker Hall.
In the Quaker Hall, there was nobody else there, thank God. And we sat across, almost exactly in the positions that we were sitting in the show, and then talked for ages. And then by the time we left, he just turned around to me and said, I want to play this part.
You mention in the book a Father William with whom you discussed his relationship with celibacy. What did he teach you?
Well, he was very kind with his approach to talking about it because he had great humour about it. Because I'd tried to speak to a couple of other priests about it, and obviously it's a sensitive subject for people. And I had to come into it very sensitively, but I wanted to basically ask them all the questions that I believed Fleabag would ask the priest. And Father William just had this huge roaring laugh and open heart, and he just believed that if people have a question, you must answer it honestly. And he said that it was a great gift for him, but also that it was something that he struggled with every day. It was part of his faith. It wasn't something that he wore as a sort of medal or anything. It was something that kept him constantly having a conversation with himself about his own solitude and his own needs. And he said something beautiful about that he knew that he was going to be the last. He knew that, I can't remember exactly what he said, I've written it down somewhere, but that when he turned the handle to close the door to his bedroom every night, he knew that he was going to be the last person, the only person to touch that door handle, and to close the door. And he got a lot of comfort out of that. But that at the same time, of course, it's lonely. And he said it could feel like a wound sometimes, which that went right through me. But then also the consistency of it is what gave him his freedom in some way as well. He taught me so much. And just even being able to call him up and say, what would the priest say in this sort of situation, like about grief, or like the priest says in episode 2, has to respond to Fleabag when he thinks that she's had a miscarriage. And just knowing that there are texts out there that you can reference. And, you know, and he said, and he came up, he was talking to me about the idea that the whole thing is sort of like poetry. You've got to interpret texts. The Bible isn't just a blueprint. It's something for you to consistently find things in. And a certain line in the Bible that might have meant a lot to you when you were 25 could mean something very different when you're 45. You interpret it differently, and actually having that to go back to all the time. And I just loved hearing about the philosophical elements of faith and religion, because we hear so much about the political influence that it can have and how kind of, you know, insidious it can be. And I just loved hearing about the good that it can bring into people's lives, the community, and the sort of conversation it prompts you to have with yourself all the time.
Would you describe yourself as a woman who has faith?
I'm an atheist, but I have faith. I have faith in people and in energy and good energy. And I have a lot of faith, but it's not directed to one God.
There is that moment at the end where he says he loves her when she declares her love for him. Why was it important that he should do that?
Well, that was Andrew. That wasn't in the script, actually. I wrote... Well, I was debating whether or not he should say it back for a while. And then when we got on set, Andrew, who was very... We worked so closely, and every time drafts came in, we would talk about it a lot. And this was one thing he was like, he has to say it back because it'll pass, being the last thing he says, could be a bit harsh. And I think it was important because it was the first time that he said something to her that was just purely about his own emotional state and how he felt about her outside of his faith, outside of religion, just about their connection. And there's something so pure about those words when they're used properly. And there was something about the symmetry of them saying it to each other made it feel equal. And that was the basis of what was inspiring to me about these two, is that they saw each other as equals. He treats her as an equal and she treats him as an equal, even though they find each other extremely eccentric in their belief systems. So it was that, really. It was that they could share it together.
And what's your thing about foxes?
I just love a fox. I just love that London has foxes. And actually, going to America, Americans didn't know that there were foxes in London. They were, so many people were like, is that a thing? There's like these animals just walking around on the street. Like, yeah, they have such swagger. There's such a kind of like swaggering sexiness about the foxes in London. They own the city. It's theirs. We're in their way. We put the lids on the bins. And that's the greatest irritation for them. And again, sometimes I'm writing and it'll just come out. And I was writing the scene about them talking about celibacy, and it just felt maybe I was getting too tense writing it because they were starting to talk about it. And then the fox speech just came out of nowhere. I just started writing it to sort of make myself laugh. And I sent it to Andrew and sent the episode to Andrew, and he just wrote back saying I cannot wait to do that bit.
Do you think I should become a Catholic?
No, don't do that. I like that you believe in a meaningless existence. And you're good for me. You make me question my faith.
And?
I've never felt closer to God.
Fuck you.
What was that? It wasn't a fox, was it?
I don't know.
Is it a fox? Shine something. Ooh! Bah! Oh, God, I bet it's a fox.
Which is a really important thing for me. I'm always thinking about the actors. I'm always writing something thinking, as an actor, I want them to read it going, oh, I can't wait, I can't wait, I can't wait.
Now, quite a bit more has happened to you since... Fleabag, a couple of awards, and then being asked to work on a Bond film.
Yeah.
What was your reaction when they said, will you come and do that?
I mean, it was a big old, yes, please. The wonderful thing about that is that those phone calls happen. Someone says, Barbara wants to meet you, and you meet Barbara, and then you got to meet Daniel, and you have these incredible conversations about this iconic character who you've grown up with. And then suddenly, when you're on board, it's like every other job, because everyone is just making a story, making a thing work. And you're just suddenly in a room again with post-its on the wall. And then you'll, you know, go to the loo and you'll see a set being built outside for some extraordinary thing. And then you're like, oh, yes, this is different. This is different from Fleabag. But it was actually seeing the stunt people, the stunt guys practicing drilling, I don't know, and that they will actually hold their hands like guns, like kids when they're rehearsing it. And I was walking past, and then they all go pew 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 for the gun sound. That was my favourite takeaway from being on a Bond set.
We should just say that it was, of course, Barbara Broccoli and Daniel Craig.
Yes.
Does he hold his two fingers and go poink poink poink?
I haven't seen him do it, but I think his stunt double did pew pew. In fact, I think there's a French contingent who go pew pew, and I think there's an English contingent who go bang bang. I don't know. It was very amusing.
So you enjoyed the whole experience?
Yeah, I mean, it was really challenging. You know, my role there was to try and be helpful and to offer things. The script was there. You know, Carrie had a really specific vision for the movie, and so did Daniel. And it had been in development for a really long time, and they had a script. And so I think it's just about that process for me was about, you know, stepping back and just saying, I'm going to give you these options, and then you can use any of them, or you can get rid of all of them, because everybody was writing on it. I mean, there were just so many ideas and so clear to so many people. I was just sort of throwing things out there and hoping that anything sticks. Yeah, I was going, pew, pew, pew. How's that?
That when Fleabag launched, you weren't married. You're now divorced and in another relationship. But I wondered, how easy is it to manage a private, a family life in the midst of the kind of fame and adulation that you have enjoyed in the past few years?
Well, I think it's just trying to keep it as private as possible, really. And I think when people realise that you're just, you know, that you are just on your sofa watching Netflix with your boyfriend, that you're not, that you're actually as boring as the rest of us, as everybody else, they kind of, you know, lose interest if you're not doing anything kind of wild. I think it's just keeping it as private. And I always had an instinct about that. You know, keep what's really precious to you as close to you as you can, and try and make the work more interesting than your life to people.
Now, Run is a new series which is going to begin, I think, on Sky Atlantic in April, written by your pal, your friend, but you have a part in it. How different a direction will that take you in?
Well, the joy of it is that I get to be the cheerleader for Vicky that Vicky's been for me this whole time. I'm an executive producer on the show, which means I'm there to support Vicky and her vision and basically just celebrate her day in, day out, and which is exactly what she's done for me for years and years and years. And seeing her on that set with a new baby, having just written the whole thing and show running it, was just the greatest. It was just the greatest feeling. And also just really fun. And I'm playing a character that she wrote for me that I would probably never have been, I'd never get to play a character like this. I would probably never have been cast for something like this if it wasn't for Vicky. And there's just something so cool about it coming back round to us working together again, except now it's HBO. And now, you know, we were filming in Toronto with this incredible set. And so it was good. It was, you know, it was another learning experience being an exec on something and being able to step back. And just all about, it just becomes all about somebody else's vision, which is really nice as well, actually.
No foxes this time, eh?
There's no foxes. Let's see if I can sneak one in.
Phoebe, thank you very much. That was lovely.
Thank you.
I was talking to Phoebe Waller-Bridge. The book, The Scriptures, is out now. And if you missed the first two series of Fleabag, and probably the last two, because I doubt she'll ever write any more, you can find them on BBC iPlayer. Bye-bye.
What are you interested in? And I mean really interested in.
Really into box certificates.
Pencils.
Crinoline mania.
So much so that if you see it, or hold it, or just think about it, then everything stops.
And then, one day, it just vanished.
Each week in the Boring Talks podcast, join me, James Ward, as I introduce a guest speaker to share their own fascination for a very niche subject.
But what could it possibly be?
From the personal joys of pencils and teletext to the expectant sounds of old computer games loading, every talk is a varied and surprising treat.
Hear that? It's lovely.
The Boring Talks. Subscribe right now on BBC Sounds.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
What is wellness?
I think of the image of wellness as like pure joy.
The important thing is for people to choose, like, what do you want to do?
Wellness are the things your grandmother told you to do.
When you really start to think about it, the answer feels more complicated. I'm Maya Feller, registered dietitian nutritionist and author.
And I'm Dr. Kavita Patel. We're the hosts of Well Now, Slate's new podcast on wellness.
Join us every Wednesday as we tackle that simple yet important question, what does it mean to be well?